The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our online daily news site, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on the iron lungs of planet Earth. Researchers have long thought that iron played an important role in the comings and goings of the planet's ice ages, but up until now, the data hasn't been very strong in support of this idea. So Dave, let's start with the basics here. What does iron have to do with ice?
Well, what's interesting about iron is that it nourishes organisms that live in the sea, specifically organisms that photosynthesize. So they're sucking carbon dioxide from the air. And what's significant about that is carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. So the more you suck from the air, the more you sequester in the sea, theoretically, the cooler the planet gets. And some people have proposed that iron-rich dust floating on the air thousands, tens of thousands of years ago seeded seas and caused perhaps one or more ice ages, because so much of the greenhouse gas was removed from the air, the Earth really cooled a lot.
Okay, so where does all this iron dust actually come from?
Well, one idea is that when sea levels are low and you have these broad areas of coastal shallows that are now not submerged anymore, it exposes the sediments that are rich in iron. And as the sediments dry out, the iron gets picked up by the wind and wafts into the sea, where it can feed these organisms that suck CO2 from the air.
So this new study brings in a new method using sediment cores to study this. What did they look for in these drill sites?
They took these core samples from several sites, and they looked at organic material that was bound to the carbonate skeletons of a particular species of sea microorganism called foraminifera. These are very tiny organisms, but they're incredibly important for ocean ecosystems. And typically, the more biologically productive an ecosystem, the more of these guys you have around. And you can actually look at the amount of nitrate dissolved by these forams to get a sense for how many of them were around, how productive this ecosystem was, and then potentially how much carbon dioxide was being sucked from the air.
There's kind of a connection here between iron dropping out of the ocean, the increase in these populations, more nitrogen being used up, and more CO2 being pulled out of the air.
Right. And what the researchers found was that they saw these relationships during the last two ice ages, where you did seem to have this boost in foraminifera activity that seemed to precede the ice age, which would suggest that these organisms were being fed by iron. They were becoming very productive. They were sucking a lot of carbon dioxide out of the air. And this may have helped bring on these ice ages.
And so how much of the carbon dioxide variation that we see, you know, with these ice ages can actually be explained by the iron dust?
Well, it's probably not the entire explanation. There's likely other factors at work. One interesting implication of the study is that so-called geoengineering efforts, these are efforts by humans to cool the planet. One idea has actually been to seed the sea with iron so that you would have this process occurring and cooling the planet if it got too hot. But it's still a little unclear about how this process works and what any potential side effects of the process are as well.
Next up, we have a story on defining the dingo. Are dingoes a species of their own, unique to Australia, or more like a cousin of domestic dogs and wolves, all descended from a common ancestor? This is actually a longstanding debate. Dave, can you take us back to the beginning? When did the dingo first show up in Australia?
Well, archaeological evidence suggests the animal arrived on the continent at least 3,500 years ago, and that it came from Asia, and that the animal there may have evolved from the wolf. And early naturalists believed that the dingo represented a new species of canine. They even gave it its own designation, Canis dingo. But over the past few hundred years, scientists have really argued about whether the dingo really deserves this classification, whether it actually is its own species, whether it's a subspecies of wolf, whether it's really just a kind of dog. And there's been a lot of inbreeding with dogs on the continent of Australia, which has caused a lot of confusion about the exact nature of these animals. They do look different. You can see a picture of one on the site. They Their coloring is a bit strange. They howl in kind of a strange way that you don't see with dogs. And there's some other features which indicates that it's an animal that really isn't like the dog and isn't really like the wolf and maybe does deserve to be called its own species. But for science, you have to be a little bit more specific than that. You can't just sort of look at an animal and say, yeah, it looks kind of different. It deserves to be its own species.
Yeah, and naming species has actually gotten harder and harder the more we find out about genetics.
That's right.
So the question here is actually how to classify these animals. Why is it an important question for the dingo?
Well, the dingo is sort of both a loved and a hated animal in Australia. Conservationists believe it should be protected because they think it plays an important role in Australia's ecosystem by eating feral cats and foxes. But ranchers consider dingoes pests because they kill valuable livestock. So if conservationists really want to save the dingo, they've got to make the case that this is a unique species that deserves to be protected.
So I gather the genetic evidence is a little hazy here. So the researchers on this paper, they wanted to get a better sample?
That's right. And they went to some museums that had dingo specimens that preceded the arrival of dogs from Europe. And that's significant because the researchers really want to figure out, what did this original animal look like? Was it a unique species? They looked at a lot of the traits of the animal. They discovered that these older dingoes had a range of coat colors, yellow, brown, ginger red, things that you don't see in modern dogs, but you do see in some modern dingoes, suggesting those dingoes did not mate with dogs and that they are unique. They also saw some things like particular shapes of the dingo skull and the architecture of their hind legs, traits that are not seen in dogs or wolves.
And so they were basically able to show that they have a lot of distinct characteristics that have only been diluted by the modern dogs, but that are not due to interbreeding with modern dogs?
That's right.
So where does this actually leave the debate? Do we now have a definition of a dingo?
Well, these researchers say that based on everything that they see, that the dingo does indeed deserve to be called its own species. They're recommending that it be reclassified as Canis dingo. It was for a while called Canis lupus dingo, which would have indicated it was a subspecies of wolf. They're really saying that this really is its own animal. But not everybody's on board. There are experts who say that this methodology in the study wasn't rigorous enough, that a lot more needs to be done to really prove that the dingo is indeed its own species.
Finally, we have a story on Neanderthals' contribution to the European physique. Neanderthals went extinct about 30,000 years ago, but not before interbreeding with nearby humans. And according to comparisons of Neanderthal genome sequences with those of modern humans, the legacy of that interbreeding is complex. So, Dave, what did Europeans and Asians inherit from our extinct cousins?
Well, Sarah, we know that Europeans and Asians got about 1-4% of their genes from Neanderthals. And that's something Africans don't share. And that's because this interbreeding that took place between Neanderthals and modern humans took place in the Middle East. And that's after the groups that would become today's Asians and Europeans migrated out of Africa. So today's Africans don't share any Neanderthal DNA. So we know Europeans and Asians got some things from Neanderthals. And there's been studies suggesting that genes involved in diseases like Crohn's disease, some immune functions, even some aspects of our skin, nails, and hair may have come from Neanderthals.
And this study is focusing on some other genes that haven't been looked at before?
Right. These are genes involved in fat metabolism. And what's interesting is when the researchers compared the genome of Neanderthals to today's Europeans and Asians, what they found was that Neanderthals and Europeans had a lot more genes involved in fat metabolism than Asians did.
So there's a commonality there in how these different bodies handle fat that isn't shared with people from Asian countries. What do we know about the specifics of these genes shared between Neanderthals and Europeans? What are their functions? Any relationship with disease?
Well, we don't know much about the function of the genes, but we know that some of them are involved in the concentration of fatty acids in the brain and also elsewhere in the body. And so the researchers actually went to some brain banks. They look at the concentrations of fats in the brains of Europeans and Asians, and they found some pretty significant differences. And they tie this all together to suggest that Europeans inherited some genes that caused Europeans to have potentially more types of fats in their brains and also in their bodies than Asians did.
And they actually speculate that this might actually be useful for Europeans because of the climate they were coming into.
Right. Both Neanderthals and Europeans were living in very cold regions of Northern Europe. And so they really needed these fats potentially to keep themselves warm, to have an extra source of energy that the ancestors of today's Asians may not have needed. And what's really cool about this is it sort of suggests that Europeans took this evolutionary shortcut, that instead of taking tens of thousands of years to evolve adaptations to the cold climate they were in, they sort of stole these genes from Neanderthals by mating with them. And so they were able to shortcut tens of thousands of years of evolution and just acquire the genes that they needed to survive this climate.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about a new generation of wearable electronics. Also a story about what makes some sperm swim faster than others. For Science Insider, our policy blog, a new report that suggests a large drop in basic research and what might be behind it. Also, we are following a misconduct case that's swirling around a couple of scientific papers that purported to show a new way to reprogram stem cells. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.